care nici am inosu. Kamanzi, Jean de Messin. Kamanzi, Jean. Kamelezi, Emmanuel. Kachizi, Teofila.
Coming back into Rwanda, we were flying over Lake Victoria, and I remember slipping a word to Elizabeth, my wife. I said, I wish I could turn back right now. And no matter how many people told me, you know, no, it's all cleaned up, and you know, you'll never recognize it. To me, it seemed like going back into hell. There were so many bodies, we couldn't pick them up. And it was this howling sound of the dogs roaming around in packs, eating the bodies, coupled with the smell of death that was around us all the time. We were literally witnessing the mass slaughter of human beings, and that would become in itself a mandate for us.
It's been 10 years where at times I want to come back, and other times I absolutely don't want to hear anything about it. At times, the mere sound of the name only throws me into a depressive state. Because this is where an experience of a lifetime was lived. This is where I significantly changed.
It wasn't like my first time arriving. It was more, geez, I'm going back into the middle of it again. I know I've been suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome, and there are times of great depression.
He had no alternative but to go back for the 10th anniversary. There seemed to be a time when he was not sure. He wanted to go back as a private citizen, but he wasn't a private citizen, and he couldn't be. So he was unnerved by some of that in advance, it seemed to me. But I thought he had to do it, and I thought it was a terrible gamble.
From your personal experience, how difficult is it to heal after a genocide?
Well, I'll tell you, it took me 7 years before I could write my book, and it took 3 years to write it. And I still take pills so that I can... I'm sort of like someone who has diabetes, who takes serum every day. I take pills just to stay reasonable. Well, it's an incredible set of emotions. Actually, having being able to drive down this road here without worrying about somebody taking a pot shot at you is already nice enough as it is.
I'd love to see Romeo liberated from the devils that haunt him. I think he's getting there slowly. I think his return trip is a pretty crucial moment in his therapy. But it's going to be hard to wrest from his soul the images that go back to 1994.
I'm seeing the differences, but I can't get the past pictures out. They keep just exploding in front of you.
Digitally clear. Really, really clear. And in slow motion.
I think the danger is it's going to consume his life. It'll just hollow him out. It'll core him out, I think. He's a man of extraordinary character. But how much can you take, for God's sake, you know?
This morning I woke up and I could hear the birds singing. I said, oh, Jesus, I brought back memories right away. And I was very hurting a lot. I'd sometimes stay up all night. I couldn't sleep, or I'd fall asleep at my desk. And then, about 4:30, 5:30, our birds would start singing. And then I'd see the crack of day, and then I'd fall asleep.
I got a call saying, do I have a problem in leaving on a UN mission? And I said, no. Do you know where Rwanda is? And I said, I think it's in Africa somewhere. And he said, yeah, well, you'll be going there.
He was quite surprised, but quite happy. And I had I was not going to say, oh, gosh, they're not going to go there. He's been waiting for so long to go in command. It was the first time they were sending a Canadian as commander of a mission in Africa.
It was like spring. The weather was magnificent. The trees, the hills, the lakes, the fresh air, the newness of meeting this culture of people who didn't have much but had a lot of inner sanctum. So it was like going to paradise on Earth.
We were extremely optimistic. We knew the country had been at war for 3 years. We knew they had signed a peace agreement, and we had spent the previous week going over that peace agreement in considerable detail. We spoke to Hutu moderates in the government and to the Tutsis of the RPF, both of whom were very pro-Arusha peace agreement and were very committed to implementing it. And their point to us was, we need help.
We were to be an easy peacekeeping mission that could be done on the cheap. We started with nothing. Few pieces of paper, pencil, not even enough cash to pay for the phone bills back to New York, and that's pretty well the resources we got.
The UN at the time was working as though it was holding together with strings and adhesive tape. They sent him out to that place without support, without briefing, without background, without knowledge. They plunked him into the middle of the most incendiary human predicament. And then, when he responded intelligently, they refused to take him seriously.
There it is. This is where we put up the UN flag on the 1st of November to show that I had taken control of the demilitarized zone, although I had only 60 officers at the time. Well, here's the place. The whole thing was a bluff. It was just a huge bluff because I had no capability of controlling the DMZ at the time. But, you know, I decided that we had to put the flag up, you know, show that we were actually moving on the agenda of the peace agreement. So you had to take the risks. And the place was just packed with people. They were all over the place, on top there, everywhere. I mean, it was a security nightmare. It was catastrophic. And so this place must have had at least 150 to 200 troops all around it. So all you needed was one guy to do one stupid thing, and then it would have been the end of the world. I was scared shitless, because the concern, the grave concern was, is once they start opening fire, how does it stop? That's the quiet tension all the time of command. You never know when something could go wrong. Although you're given your orders and the situation is complex and so on,
You just hope that all that has fallen into place and that the human factor, which becomes what we call often the fog of war, doesn't mess it up.
We started to really understand that there was a thing out there that we called the third force. It wasn't just a government and the rebels. There was a third group, and it was a group that was determined not to see Arusha implemented. We had seen these guys running around in baggy colored suits, and they looked like a bunch of clowns. It turned out they were the Interahamwe. They were the youth wing and the extremists. They did hate Tutsis and they wanted to kill them. They listened to the propaganda at the radio station that the Tutsis were a threat. They were coming back to take back our land, take away everything we have.
You can understand an entire people growing up learning certain mythologies about themselves and their neighbors. And all the Hutu grew up, often in church-sponsored schools, learning that the Tutsi were different and probably alien.
The problem that essentially was created by the Belgians, who had this country as a colony, you know, through their whole ethnicity exercise and their anthropologists who had gone on a wild spree of idiotic theories and sizes of heads and this and that, and the administrators included the ethnicity on the ID cards. And that then splits the country and identifies you as elements of difference.
I understand the intense ethnic hatreds weren't really in the soul of Hutu and Tutsi, but were stoked and encouraged by the imperial powers over the years.
The first time I saw a gun in 1960, it was with a priest, a Belgian priest, who was helping the group of civilians killing the Tutsi in 1960.
Normally, it has been UN practice that the former colonial power does not participate in peacekeeping missions on former colonies. So the Belgians technically should not have come to that mission, but they were the only ones that were putting well-led, well-trained, well-experienced, well-equipped troops on the ground. Canada accepted the force commander's position, but could not give the contingent. Because Canada at the time was literally out of troops. The Ghanaians contributed a battalion, and the Tunisians contributed a company, and the other 400 was Bangladesh. That then became our force.
Okay, good job, thank you.
Bonjour. They recruit them pretty young here in this country. During the war, you could find them 15 years old, 14, 15. The aim was to find any way of breaking the political impasse and to offer up a safe place where Kagame and Habyarimana could meet. And in this very humble place, they could do that. I had brought generators, I had brought computers, I brought everything. No lighting, nothing. We had to bring the tables and chairs ourselves. There's so many things that conspire to make it impossible. I had extremists, I had hardliners, and I had moderates. Now, these guys did not believe the war was over. And as much as I kept telling them, listen, you're at peace. The peace agreement has been signed. You are in the process of moving to a whole new political plan. There could have been possibilities. But by then, they knew that they were going to keep the war going. They knew they were going to do the massacres and then relaunch the war. The whole damn thing is what could have been. The lost opportunities, the decisions that created far more complexity than solutions. Anyways, maybe it's just another naive idea.
What the world fails to understand is that there was diplomatic information flowing in significant quantities. The French, the Italians, the Vatican, the various governments that had missions in Rwanda, they were sending reports at the end of 1993 and early 1994, which signaled an apocalypse.
The French government worked with the Rwandan government that was planning the genocide, knew everything that was going on, and not only didn't complain, but did the opposite, legitimized and spoke on behalf of the government everywhere in the world. So the French government kept giving the killers the conviction that they could get away with murder.
From the 11th of January onwards, it went straight downhill. Jean-Pierre, the informant, apparently was a successful soldier and then had been tasked training the Interahamwe. He told us he was being asked to prepare lists of Tutsis and to have them in the hands of Interahamwe. And he knew that what they were doing was preparing for extermination. He said there were four arms caches in the city of Kigali. General Dallaire's intention was to raid the arms caches and to knock the Interahamwe right off their feet.
This was a culminating point. This was the point in which we would actually change the nature of the operations that were going on.
The wires between Kigali and New York were burning red hot that whole week. They came back and forbid that operation. Initially, we thought they just don't understand, that they didn't understand what his words were. It wasn't a case of the words. The words were pretty clear. It was the fact that they were just gun-shy.
I literally felt that I had been chopped at the knees, that I had this thing in the bag and that it had been taken away from me.
General Romeo Dallaire was naive about the workings of the United Nations. How could you be otherwise? It is the most complex and mystical Byzantine labyrinth in the world. He didn't understand that if he went to New York and made his case and they gave him a hearing, that didn't mean that they would comply.
Then the bastards should have pulled us out. They should have done that. The future of a nation was riding a lot on how the UN was doing it.
Literally, it was like watching a fuse burn to a powder keg. And then in March and April, we could just sense that it was deteriorating. And finally, there was an explosion.
Heavy fighting has broken out around the capital of Rwanda hours after the president died in a plane crash.
The plane was shot down by a rocket near the Kigali airport.
That means that the government has collapsed. It's not at all clear who's in charge of Rwanda at the moment.
I was very worried. I would get up in the morning, put the TV on and the radio and listen to whatever piece of news I could get. And quite often I had to tell the children, well, don't worry, he's still alive, he's okay. I lied so much during that period, but I had no choice, I had to.
I remember what I told my son. Poor kid was barely 15, and as we flippantly do, you know, you're now the man of the house, and you take care of things, and something, you know, very, very man thing, you know, sort of slap on the back there, boy, and all that. And when the war started and there was a great risk of me becoming a casualty, the impact of that on my son was just beyond description. He felt that he was not able to do that. Yet his dad told him, parting words.
General Dallaire, we've been hearing all kinds of reports that all hell is breaking loose. What has been going on?
If you stated that all hell's breaking loose in Kigali, that would be a reasonably fair statement.
There was a lot of confusion and a lot of panic. Phone calls were coming in about 100 an hour. The overwhelming majority of those people that I spoke to were killed that day. They didn't live. And there were teams of presidential guards that moved in. They knew exactly where those moderate ministers, their families, the opposition leaders were. They grabbed the individuals, took them away, killed them. This was a very, very well-planned and extremely well-executed attack on Hutu moderate ministers and innocent Tutsis.
What was really in my mind was, what in the hell is going to happen? Will I be able to prevent this turning into a civil war or a genocide? And so I had troops all over that were getting reports that were disappearing, that the Belgians were being tabassé, beaten up.
We knew that whites will be killed in Rwanda. That was clear. The message was done by Radio LTRM. Don't worry about those white soldiers who are here. If we kill some of them, they will all leave.
We've heard reports that three UN military observers were killed and perhaps others. What is the situation with that?
We've lost more than that. I'm really not in a position to give you the figure until they release it.
But more than three?
Yes, yes, I'm afraid so.
All of a sudden, I'm turning my head, and two Belgians were near that roundabout thing over there. If I've got two laying down on the ground, that means I'm taking casualties. So I took off in search of Bagasora. One way or another, he had the power, the authority to stop this whole thing. And so the door was closed, so I just knocked and barged in. When he realized I was there, he leapt up and came to me. That's when he said that the Belgians had to get out.
They knew that if they wanted to get rid of the major capability within Unimir, the glue that held the whole force together was the Belgian contingent. And they struck directly at the Belgian contingent, killed 10 of its soldiers.
Some of the comments are that we could have attacked this position to save the soldiers. There was just absolutely no way, as it was so well defended. Non, je veux que tu sois avec moi. C'est ici que mes soldats sont morts. C'est ici que toute la maudite polémique. Yeah. Oui, mais ça a été aussi une grande question de mes décisions à ce moment-là. I'd say de venir les sauver.
Part of the argument that some people find difficult is why didn't I go rescue those 10 Belgians and screw the rest of the mission?
So, do I send another bunch in and end up, what, 20, 30 casualties? And on top of that, they could just blast the shit out of my headquarters and my mission would have been over. Yeah, well, some of the stuff actually made it through. Well, you can see the bullet holes, and then what you really can see is where they got those candles, is where the grenade was thrown in.
Commanders have got to be able to function, not only with the decision, but the effects of the decision. And if you can't function with the effects of the decision, then you don't have the right to command.
We've heard reports that the fighting has started again.
Western nations are racing to remove their nationals from the country and its tribal warfare.
One of the great missed opportunities was in the first 3 days when the Italians and the Belgians and the French all sent planes in to rescue their own expatriates. And there was a force of 2,500, all armed to the teeth. Every single one was obsessed only with saving his own expatriates. They didn't know much of what was happening. They didn't care what was happening. Africans weren't going to kill Africans. What was it their business? And not one of them, not one single one of them, was offered to Dallaire to help in saving the Tutsi. And if at that moment they had united behind Dallaire, they could have stopped the damn thing within 2 or 3 days, and not one single country soldiers did it. This is what kills, I think, Romeo Dallaire, is that there were so many moments when a simple if only had been operationalized, whole thing could have stopped. Instead, it was never, ever stopped.
Are all humans human? Or are some more human than others? Rwanda and its problems were just of no significance.
What is it about Rwanda? What was it about that period? Why was there this incredible moral default on the part of the world? I guess when you strip everything away, Africa didn't count anymore.
Okay.
And Africa was Africa. It was black. So all of the unlovely racist impulses could also come into play. And Africa had nothing to sell, nothing to buy. You just wrote off the continent, and Rwanda in 1994 was the sort of apotheosis of that feeling.
General Dallaire's initial approach was for reinforcement of the mission.
Send me troops.
You know, if you give me 5,000 troops, I can do more if you give me more. And the Belgians were supporting that initially the first couple of days. But when they realized that no one was going to reinforce the mission, the Belgians then made the decision to withdraw. At the time where Rwandese needed them the most, they put their tail between their legs and they ran away.
It's ironic that in the same days 50 years previous, my father was with other Canadians, dying, some of them, and a number of them, and injured and so on, fighting to liberate Belgium, while Belgians still had that colony under their control, and troops in the colony, and still raping it at the time. I mean, the perverseness of that is just beyond me. Anybody who felt threatened ran to this site because it was a UN site.
The Rwandese community who had stayed around the place were being protected by the UNAMI at that time. That the number was between 2,000 and 2,050.
Right.
They came here to...
To be protected.
To be protected. Mm. But later they were left.
So the 11th, the Belgians had given their orders already to start moving. So my orders to consolidate then just got absorbed and overridden by Belgian orders to pull out. The Belgians pulled out, the people stayed here, and then the government troops came in with the Interahamwe. The Interahamwe was simply driving by, doing killing in the area. If I'd known there were civilians here, then I would have taken troops from another contingent that was staying and put them in here, and so keep the UN presence. But that never happened, because they never knew about it, and then it was too late. I mean, these places were just bloodbaths. You would hear what seemed to be a grunt, and on occasion there'd be an injured body still alive. It used to be most unnerving, to say the least. This stuff is still of 10 years ago. Always shoes or thongs.
You know, shirt, rags, everything.
They ran, they must have ran fast and went barefeet. They were faster barefeet.
I cannot understand how you kill a one-week-old baby. How you can take a pregnant woman and take the baby and kill both of them. They have never been able to find a good explanation, but the truth of the matter is that it happened.
Once you've killed once, then the whole inhibition has disappeared. And so it becomes an act of slaughter. You create such an atmosphere in yourself that there's a certain gaiety in it. You know, geez, I chopped that guy's head off in one shot. That was a lot better than before. And then the other ones, well, I chopped the knees off, or I chopped this guy's penis off, and did you see him run? And that whole thing then gets like a tonic, or it's like booze, you know, and you just get more and more drunk.
Bonjour, ça va?
Fidel is one of the survivors.
Oh, oui, si. Vous avez monté jusqu'ici, vous aussi, hein?
Non, non, moi je ne suis pas arrivé ici, mais toute ma famille est ici. Hein.
Toute votre famille est ici?
Moi j'étais à Kipchkiran. Hein.
Ah. Alors, combien de membres de votre famille?
Ouf, 12, 13.
Vos parents?
Mes parents.
Vos parents à vous?
Mes enfants.
Combien d'enfants?
Ma famille. Et mes petits frères, tout ça.
Oui. Hein.
C'est une grande famille, hein? On était à 16 maintenant, on est à 2.
Shit. Incredible. Ça a été un scandale. C'est un scandale comment les soldats sont partis d'ici. Et ont abandonné les gens parce que ce n'était pas dans leurs ordres.
No, he has a hard time dealing with that, I think.
Oh, yeah.
All the casualties, all the people that were killed. He tried his best, but he couldn't control everything.
It's when you're all of a sudden back and you have a few moments that you get invaded, literally. It's like you're in a bath and you're all of a sudden you find yourself underwater. And then you fall into these bubbles of enormous depression.
Dallaire is wrong to be abusing himself, has been wrong all these years to be blaming himself for taking the responsibility for the failure. Yes, it was a failure, and no, he couldn't have done a damn thing about it.
When the Belgians left, I had tears by the fact that I was being left by these guys with a ragtag outfit that had next to no capability. And they were leaving as people were being chopped up all around the goddamn place. I mean, they had to avoid bodies all over the place to even get here. I'm standing here, abandoned by that Hercules aircraft that's going there, in a pile of absolute disgusting horror, mutilation, brutality that essentially was started up by these same bastards that were taken off. Tears were pouring out of my face. I mean, I was the rage. I mean, The tears were just flowing. I was standing right here, over here.
À cause de Beret qu'on a des mots. Parce que ça, c'est un signe de suicide.
And so what else do you expect me to do is just develop an absolute hatred for the government and the Belgian structures. My hatred was beyond bounds, and it stayed like that for many, many years.
Ils ont laissé les gens mourir. Ils savaient bien qu'ils allaient mourir. Mais ils ont préféré partir. Partout dans les rues, il y avait des cadavres. Il y avait des amis qui étaient devenus les ennemis, ni les voisins. Personne ne voulait accepter. On n'avait vraiment pas refuge.
They called us on the radio with a very faint radio message that there had been killing at the church. The army had cordoned off the area and very carefully rounded up everybody with a Tutsi identity card. They had taken the people to the church and then they hand them over to the Inter-Amway who did the killing. And there was no one spared, no child, no woman, no one was spared. These are people who lived in the same community together, went to the same church. Literally one parishioner killed another parishioner.
Catholic Church could have stopped the entire thing years before it began. They were the largest church in Rwanda. They had extraordinary influence both with the government, with the elite, and at the mass, the parish level. And if they had said that the anti-Tutsi behavior was simply a sin against God, it would have been stopped. And the church refused to do that. They believed democracy equaled quantity. And since there were far more Hutu than Tutsi, it was proper that the Hutu should run everything. So the Catholic Church have gotten away with murder, literally.
Oh, it's a lot cleaner.
Thank you.
Looks much smarter than before. Okay, so what do we got? We got the camera there. For the TV?
Television.
And we got the radio also?
Yes.
Very good.
General Ramon Darir, it's almost 10 years since you left this country. Mm. And what moved you to write this book, Shake Hands with the Devil?
Well, the first thing was is that I felt I had a responsibility to describe it. So I felt it was essential. And I wanted my children, and particularly my grandchildren, to know what their grandfather did and didn't do in the genocide of Rwanda.
Yeah, according to the title of your book, Shake Hands with the Devil, I think you can take this chance to explain more on the title of this book.
Yes. There were two occasions where I met with the Inter-Amway leaders. And when I shook their hands were cold. But they weren't cold as a temperature. They were cold as if another body. Although they had a human form, their eyes were not human. Their eyes were reflecting the most evil that I could ever imagine. It was being personified, and that personification coming from my religious background was the devil.
There comes a moment in time when human behavior is capable of the most ferocious and irrational activity. This capacity to go berserk, to have no semblance of feeling for the human condition at all, apparently it lies in us. Apparently it lies in human behavior. I don't know what is so crazed as to trigger it, but it's there.
Will those members of the council in favour of the draft resolution 488 please raise their hand?
In a special session last night, the UN Security Council voted to withdraw all but 300 peacekeepers from the Central African country.
I don't think walking away from here is a position that should even be contemplated.
I knew Ramir wouldn't come back. Ramir's not the type of person to just drop everything and take off. Anybody in his right mind couldn't have done that. Just to abandon a whole nation? The United Nations. Abandon the country.
General Dallaire, are you not going to be in harm's way should anything erupt?
Well, I think what we're doing is exactly what we should be doing.
At that point, he did not force any of us to stay. And he called me into his office, I can remember quite clearly. He called me in, he said, you know, you've got a wife at home, you've got a three-year-old, a one-year-old, and a brand new baby. He says, if you want to go, I'll understand. I said, no. I said, as long as you stay, I stay.
The small UN force in Rwanda has been doing its best to save lives.
What kept us going? You know, what kept me going? In all that kind of stuff. I guess, couldn't accept that I was going to be defeated. And maybe it's a terrible romantic side. To the last man, God damn it, to the last man, they were not going to get us.
First thing is, you can't imagine how pissed off I am of having to wait outside that gate. Be treated just as a goddamn tourist.
I'm no more a king of the hill there. Boy, I was nothing more than some white guy trying to come in and didn't have the authority to do it. It is so perfectly reflective of the organization. It's all there. In a microcosm, it was all there.
You can come in, please.
Okay.
Yeah? I'm very sorry about all this. You know UN.
Well, you're absolutely right, Frank.
Yeah.
The whole place has changed.
Yeah.
Standing there on the road and watching everybody, you know, hustle around to that. All I could see was the past. The smell had come back, the vulnerability of my headquarters to attack and so on. I mean, it's as if in many cases it was just yesterday. I was going through all that. That afterwards, I said, "Well, you know, Dallaire, that's past."
Bonjour,
General Dallaire. I presume.
That is correct. I presume.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So much about you.
Well, that's very kind. I'm just coming to see what sort of decorations you put in my office.
Is this your previous office?
Yes.
Oh, welcome.
Yeah.
You're most welcome.
I need food, medicine, and material for 2 million people. We're all late. We're already weeks and weeks late.
One night, I'm expecting the attack, and I hear this sound. The breeze had come through this screen, and this sense that it was either a lot of screaming going on from the distance, or there was also this sense as if something had touched me. And it gave me a real whiff of strength. As much as I was negotiating with the devil, I felt that there was a very positive entity that came all of a sudden and gave me just that impetus that I needed. to keep moving with the mission with as much vigor that I could. Ah, oui, I'm dans ça tout est.
Well, he was transferring patients. Well,
we were doing it all the time.
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
That
I remember.
Was one of the big
we were
activities.
Moving them by sure. with the escorts.
That's right.
Ah, yeah.
That's
I remember
right.
Now.
The first night that I arrived, I literally just came from the airport, and I remember some horrible, horrible scenes there.
Mm.
On one particular day, there were hundreds of casualties. And there were also some difficulties with some of the killing squads and the militias at some of the checkpoints. General Dallaire himself actually arrived in an APC. And I just remember him getting out and screaming and yelling. And I remember seeing these guys, these Interahamwe, just basically melting away in his presence and in his booming voice. And yeah, General Dallaire. He did everything that was humanly possible.
This is where, what, 6,000, 7,000 people stayed?
Many
in this,
thousand.
In this, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, at least.
Yeah.
And this was for the Tunisians?
Right here, inside this fence. It was just full of people all the time. Eh, cooking and making their little... Yeah, and remember we couldn't get you water. And
water was a huge problem.
Trying to get that through the hoses. Yeah. Remember the hoses and pumping? There were hoses all over the floor. They're trying to pump water into here to get you some. Yeah, what a carnage. What a carnage.
There's a lot of failures here in Rwanda. But there are a few examples of individuals who didn't fail as people, as men. As women, and General Dallaire is probably the best example of that.
It's been a long time coming, General, you know?
Yes, sir.
It's been a long time coming.
Oh, shit.
His actions and his leadership directly saved thousands of lives.
Yeah. You don't get much solace in that, though. It did, in so many others that you never got to. In early May, we ran out of food and water, and there was no medical supplies, and we were taking casualties still. And the slaughtering was still ongoing, and I was getting nothing from the world.
This meeting is adjourned.
Could not believe that people would leave us in that much of a scenario of risk and impotency. And be able to go home at night. And I must say, my loyalty to the UN and to the world was tested beyond belief.
Most people in most of the world was absolutely fascinated by O.J. Simpson's gloves. Couldn't give a tinker's damn about what happened in Rwanda. Didn't really realize it, that it was a blip. It happened. They saw it on television. The effect was that deep. And then the cameras moved on to other things.
I think a couple of times at night, I would sit there and go, you know, like, what the heck am I doing here? Especially when, you know, Canada didn't reinforce the mission, the United States didn't reinforce the mission, the UN wasn't reinforcing the mission. We even got a call at one point where they said, there's no cavalry over the hill, nobody's coming to get you guys out.
Sense of isolation that that provides just absolutely overwhelms, because all of a sudden you realize I'm surrounded, so we got to make our stand here.
The UN compound in Kigali also took a number of direct hits. Canadian UN commander Major General Romeo Dallaire is pinned down in the capital.
So when the bombardments would happen, everybody would come down the stairs and we would essentially sit here. If we had had a direct hit, I had nothing for the people. I had no medical supplies. And so every bombardment, I saw these visions of all of a sudden around coming in through the door and absolutely obliterating this place. And all it would be a carnage, because we had absolutely nothing else.
I mean, we're all just cringing here in his deathly silence. You could see the fear in people's eyes. So I ran back up to my office, got my little radio that my sister had sent me, battery operated, brought it down, put it in the middle here, and put Stomping Tom Connors on.
Yes, we are the Blue Berets. We're up and on our way with another UN flag to be unfurled.
And so the bombs are falling, and people are clapping their hands, you know, and listening to the music of Stomping Tom Connors. And it was great.
Our family and our friends who come to call. If you count the lonely days, you'll see your Blue Berets marching home again to say we love you all.
General, we hope you have a peaceful, uneventful weekend.
If I do, it'll be the first one since I've been here.
Canadian military personnel usually don't talk frankly to the media, if they in fact talk at all. So to find a general in a war situation willing to come on the telephone and talk to the CBC as candidly as he did was astounding.
Let me ask a dumb question. Why not pull out completely?
Morally, that would be totally unacceptable. It would be like saying, we're going to pull out, and when you finish beating each other around the head, then we'll come back, and then we'll start being a good guy, and then, you know, we'll work together.
It was a very calculated decision by General Dallaire to use the media to get the word out to the world of what was happening in Rwanda. He used to say that one reporter with an NMARSAT is worth a battalion of troops on the ground.
Do you think the worst of it's over now as far as civilian deaths are concerned?
I'd be at a loss to tell you if it is stopped, because every day we hear about another horror story here or another mortar bomb drop in to wipe out a whole bunch of them.
So he actually approached reporters, and Mark Doyle of BBC was the most classic example of a guy who accepted it. He said, if you stay on the ground, we'll water you, we'll feed you, we'll protect you. I really don't care what you report, but I want you to file a story a day and I'll ensure that it gets out.
The massacres by government militia has caused millions of Rwandans to be displaced.
The rebels now hold at least three sides of the city. The government army, in the military bases it still holds, is resisting strongly.
But the rebels have vowed to continue their advance until the massacre of their supporters stops. Mark Doyle, BBC News, Kigali.
I'll never forget these shops here. Mm. Remember, there was just so many dead bodies in all of them.
Yeah.
That the whole place just stank.
It stank. And then we set a fire, a diesel fuel fire, with all the bodies because it was stinking so much. I mean, we couldn't work anymore here. The stench just entered your pores.
It just became so dangerous that the only place that you could stay with any sort of security at all was this UN building here. I was here on the ground with him, seeing what his soldiers were doing, seeing the appalling conditions that they were working under, and you would see that he was trying to carry on talking to everybody with one aim in mind, which was to save the lives of Rwandans within the realms of the possible.
A journalist once asked me, he said, what in the hell are you doing here? I mean, why are you staying? And I blurted out, I said, if I can save one Rwandan, then it's worth it. And the journalist said, yeah, but there are tens of thousands being slaughtered every day. And I said, then maybe if I can be a witness, maybe I'll have a chance to tell everything that we were seeing. When the war started, the place filled up. And at one point, we were up to 12,000 in here. So you imagine 12,000 people trying to live in here. So you get this latent smoke that hangs in here. And then all you see is people and clothes, you know, rags and stuff. And so the place looks absolutely, totally out of control. it became, in probably the most pejorative way, sort of like a concentration camp. We were out there protecting them, but as we were protecting them out there, they're inside dying. Because of lack of water, lack of food. You see a graveyard? Where are we going to build a graveyard? And the stench, yeah, the stench was so powerful, you had to actually force yourself not to puke or anything. Yes, sir. And then you are, of course, as the commander, to be held accountable for the actions of your mission. And not 10 minutes afterwards, for the rest of your life. For the rest of your life.
And there are times where I just felt like getting on the phone and calling out and saying, is there anyone alive out there? Like, where is the world? Are you all sleeping?
So, you know, we went through a lot of shit today that, you know, I saw and stuff like that. But it's catching up on me, and I'm being pushed too much.
You could see it happen in little things. I guess the first sign to me was that his writing just came apart at the seams. There were days when he would sit down to write an order of some kind, which just make no sense. They were incoherent bits and pieces slammed together.
And trying to keep commanders focused and trying to keep some of them from simply giving up and getting drunk and hoping the whole goddamn thing disappears.
It became clear to me near the middle of July that he had just gotten too tired. His eyes were just glazed over. He didn't recognize me. He'd hit the wall finally, had given everything he had and nothing left.
I was becoming very aggressive, unreasonable. I'd take off for 2-3 hours alone. I would be daring the Hutus to try to kill me. And I felt I was starting to put the mission at risk. And so I felt that I had to be relieved.
On voit pas aussi clairement jusqu'en bas.
Ah,
OK? C'était plus
ça
bas.
Ça coupait à vue.
Yeah, ça coupait à vue.
Ah, ouais.
Ça fait que. Tu vois maintenant, là, regarde le soleil est sur. Hein?
Ouais. Oui, oui. That panorama was like taking her into my secret place.
Tu vois tout à coup une autre petite montagne.
It's like, you know, when you're young, you have your secret friend that maybe doesn't exist. And all of a sudden, you're letting somebody else know that secret.
C'est-tu que je vais revenir humain?
Quand tu
venais ici? Dans le livre, là, où ce que je décris.
Ouais.
La seule place où ce que...
In those first years back in Canada, I had no idea that what I had sensed in Rwanda and asked to be relieved was actually still affecting me. And so this was just, you know, another goddamn battle to fight.
Là, t'as du thé là-bas.
When he came back after the 4 months of terrible genocide and going back to the civilized world, it was quite a shock for him. And at one point, I realized that he was blaming himself for things that had happened. I said, gosh, how can you blame yourself? How can you blame yourself? You did what you could. You couldn't do more than what you did. I knew there was something going wrong there.
As you may have heard, General Dallaire was unfortunately back in the news last week. On Monday night, he was hospitalized after passing out drunk under a park bench in Hull, Quebec.
I became suicidal. because there was no other solution. You couldn't live with the pain and the sounds and the smell and the sights. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't stand the loudness of silence. And you get into a spiral. And the spiral just goes faster and faster. And you sometimes just see no other option than plowing your car into the bridge that's coming. So if I had not gone to get help, I think I'd be dead. Okay.
So remember this place?
Yes, sir, very much.
He gave this speech in Butare, which is the major university town in Rwanda. And you come to the stadium and you find that it's absolutely packed. So that's in itself impressive, or maybe intimidating. Here's a whole lot of the future of the country who want to see and know something about Dallaire.
Mesdames et messieurs, le monde est géré par un concept qui va permettre d'autres génocides. Vous n'étiez aucunement dans l'intérêt national ou personnel des grandes puissances. Ils étaient intéressés à la Yougoslavie. Alors, des milliards et des milliers de soldats rentrent en ex-Yougoslavie et ici, je me ramasse avec à peine 450. Et le principe était qu'au Rwanda, c'est du tribalisme, c'est de l'histoire qui se répète. En Yougoslavie, c'est différent. C'est 400 ans d'histoire entre les grandes religions du monde. C'est du nettoyage ethnique. C'est la sécurité de l'Europe. C'est des Blancs. Le Rwanda, c'est noir, c'est en plein cœur de l'Afrique, il n'y a aucune valeur stratégique. Et tout ce qu'il y a là, qu'on m'a répondu, c'était des humains et il y en a trop de toute façon. Et donc, c'est devant vous que je vous dis que Roméo Dallaire, commandant de la force, a failli le peuple rwandais dès le mois de janvier
94. Gladly, I have learned a very good man is around, General Dallaire.
That I used to have a discussion with him many times when genocide was taking place. I asked him what he, as a general, and his forces were doing to stop the genocide. And the answer to me was that he did not have the mandate. Then I asked him, what about the arms? What about the soldiers you have? What about the APCs? The answer was, no mandate. Then I would ask, I say, then what are you doing here? You have no mandate, you're not going to protect people, so what are you doing here?
Vous étiez sur place au moment du génocide, et pourquoi vous n'avez pas
fait ce génocide? He's always going to find people there who are suspicious of him. Why didn't he quit? Why, after the famous genocide facts of January the 11th, 1994, when he found the goods, when he was told the possibility of extermination existed, and he was told by the New York office that he couldn't do a damn thing about it, well, why didn't he quit? That question will forever come and haunt him.
Évidemment, tout ce que le général Dallaire a dit ouvre matière à débat. Est-ce qu'il faut obéir à un ordre, oui ou non? Est-ce que les ordres sont légaux? On ne doit surtout pas obéir à un ordre légal lorsque sa conscience, évidemment, est totalement contre cet ordre.
To me, having disobeyed the orders would have been showmanship, would have been Hollywood, would have been totally irresponsible.
Alors, un général ne se ramasse pas sur le terrain et commence à décider si lui ou non il va suivre des ordres légaux. Pas illégaux, légaux.
Je voudrais vous dire, selon moi, quelles sont les trois fautes du général Dallaire. Il a obéi à un ordre criminel qui était de ne rien faire pour prévenir la vie des Tutsis. Vous savez qu'il est passé devant le camp Kigali et il a vu deux casques bleus belges à terre à un moment où au moins six autres vivaient encore.
Senator Destex, out of the blue, launched a personal attack on Romeo Dallaire for allowing, these were words, he helped kill the 10 Belgian soldiers. This was immediately clear to me that this was opportunistic and it was done just because there were a whole lot of international media sitting in the front row.
Sachez aussi que j'essaie depuis des mois d'organiser une réunion entre le général Dallaire et les veuves des paracommandos assassinés ici au Rwanda et que le général Dallaire, pour des raisons que je ne comprends pas, refuse de rencontrer les veuves des paras assassinés.
I was just furious. And in fact, it happened exactly as Destex wanted it to. Stole the media for 2 days. What do the media do? They do fights. Here was the fight between Romeo Dallaire and Senator Destex of Belgium.
J'ai jamais dit que je ne les rencontrerai jamais.
C'est qu'ils n'ont pas accès à vous aussi facilement.
C'est pas vrai. Ils n'ont rien qu'à m'écrire.
Ils ne savent même pas où vous écrire. Enfin
bon. Bullshit. Yeah. I mean, what they're doing is they want to use the occasion just to beat the shit.
Yeah, how are you?
You know, that's right. And the occasion is simply not appropriate.
Some people will say you did a shitty job, and other people will say, well, you did pretty good. And so you've got to work with that, and if you're not convincing, then you must live with the full consequence of it. Part of the argument that some people find difficult is, why am I not mourning more the 10 Belgians than I am the rest of the whole mission, the rest of the whole time? And I just can't do that. I just can't do it. There were millions of Rwandans who are still suffering, and the whole whack of them who died too. So it's the proportionality of all that.
How did he cope? Well, it was facing the worst. I believe he put himself through a series of very explicit, specific, and conscious tests. And every moment there's a chance of regression, a chance to just lose all the progress that he'd made.
It was a mangy night. The lighting was no screaming hell. And as we came down here, we could just see a pile. And as we got closer, we could make out, in fact, that there was a pile of dead bodies, just piled, you know, two or three on the bottom, and then you just keep piling them up just like sacks of potatoes, just this way and that. I told them that this was ignoble, that this was impossible to believe that fighting soldiers had been, you know, who had been fighting, had been dumped there just like a whole bunch of packs of potatoes. And so the mound came back. I mean, it really was there. The bodies and so on, and the blood. And so that overwhelmed. It was really, really there.
And then we could hear the moans and the screams of those who were injured or being operated on and so on from over there. And so I don't know how much time we spent here. Seemed like years. It's a funny guilt, eh? Part of the guilt is why are they dead and not you? Why did they have to die? Why didn't you die? To see your troops, to see anyone treated in that fashion, but in your troops and your command, is something that they don't teach in any of the schools. And we do lots of exercises, lots of cowboys and Indians in the old sort of way, or the Rambo-esque crap. But you gotta bring the reverence to it, and you gotta bring the significance to it, because every life counts. The soldier, the innocent, the bystander, or the belligerent, they're all human lives. Better.
Thank you for coming.
I am honored to be with you. He has not changed an iota. Still very much in command. Still gets respect, and in an incredible fashion. 10 years later, I wanted to renew that contact, that it is a respect for the man, and I think it probably mutual.
Well, first of all, the whole international system has a serious problem. It was like you had handcuffs on your arms, you know, you were tied, and you were tied as to, you know, the kind of things you have to do and others you can't do. I would put every blame on other people other than Dalair. I think the blame is on at that time, the UN Security Council, the members, the permanent members who made wrong, totally wrong and responsible decisions. General Dalair was just a pawn in the middle of a very complex mess.
We hope and we pray.
I was personally distraught by the failure of the Western world to come down to Rwanda to join the ceremony on the 10th anniversary. Here was Canada sending a former cabinet minister, and there was the United States sending, well, he wasn't a junior fellow, he was the ambassador for war crimes, but he was a long way down. I asked a lot of Rwandans about this turnout, and they said, you know what? We didn't expect any more. So we're not happy, we're a little disappointed, but we've come to expect nothing from the world, and the world never disappoints us in that way.
It is also the fault of those countries, the powerful countries, who are so arrogant that they can dictate what happens in every other country. As for the French, they know England, trained and armed government soldiers and militia who were going to commit genocide.
He was brutal, if we look in diplomatic terms, absolutely brutal. Why should he be a nice guy today? I mean, 10 years ago, they were, we worked through the diplomatic channels and political channels, and he ended up with a goddamn genocide. Since then, a bunch of them coming to excuse themselves and, hey, beat them over the head. They deserve it. And every one of them that tries to get rid of the blood on their hands will paint it back.
I have come today to pay the respects of my nation to all who suffered and all who perished in the Rwandan genocide. It may seem strange to you here, especially the many of you who lost members of your family, but all over the world, there were people like me sitting in offices day after day after day who did not fully appreciate the depth and the speed with which you were being engulfed by this unimaginable terror.
I think Clinton knew exactly what was going on in Rwanda. As in so many other things, his mind was off somewhere else at the time, and he just didn't take it seriously enough. And all this caterwauling about, if only I had known, spare me. He knew. These people know they were wrong. They know that their behavior allowed the worst genocide at the end of the 20th century that is imaginable. And they still, to this day, cannot acknowledge it and cannot atone for it and cannot have the decency and the courage to present themselves to Rwanda and say, we were wrong, we're here to commemorate the horror with you. We will stand shoulder by shoulder by you as you attempt to overcome the inheritance. But the world just copped out again. That, I guess, is what makes one feel maybe it could happen again. If you're so irresolute 10 years after the event, then maybe it could happen again. Maybe that's just a commentary on how delinquent we are.
When I put the rose down, it meant touching again. Being with all those victims. Because touching him as we were doing would freeze your hand, because the cold of death has no temperature. It just stings.
Bicicero was quite a revelation.
So, Thierry, what do we do? Ah, ici, c'est toutes les crânes puis tout ça. Yeah. Oh, oui.
So I said to myself, take a deep breath and go in, and that's it.
The people who died here were killed by machetes, and most of them were shot.
It's shocking because you see all those people killed, and some of the skulls were small, so those were children. And some of them were not complete, so they were really tortured.
How long were they able to fight before the whole massacre happened?
They were able to defend themselves for 3 months, and they decided to go and hide in the bush because they knew that they couldn't
resist anymore.
It's pure luck. Nobody protected them. It's just hands of God.
Paradise was assaulted by the devil. And the devil did its best to destroy it. Imagine yourself with somebody who looks nasty. And he's standing behind you and he's got a loaded pistol. And that person is telling you that if you do not commit a horrific act, he's going to shoot you. Would you commit that act? And how much time would you think the guy will give you to debate that? They would take children, kill them, and then say, see, well, we've just done that. We're going to do that to you now. And he said, you go there next door and you kill that person right now. And the hesitation is enough for them to kill you. It's not an excuse. It's a fact of humanity.
So the burial site represents how many people were killed and so on?
It's around 60 and 70,000 people.
What kept their morale to continue to fight instead of giving up, like so many other places
have?
They didn't want just wait for someone to come and chop the head. What they did, they said, we're going to fight as long as we can, even if there is one person who will survive to come and tell what happened here.
Right. Well, I cannot explain how much, as a soldier, I am impressed with the courage and the determination and resiliency mm-hmm. of this battle. I mean, ended up by being a massacre, of course, but it is far more one of those great battlegrounds, you know, in the world where brave people have fought and ultimately died for what they believed in. And the battle was against evil, against the devil, and yet they still were able to fight for 3 months. Mm. If I've been able to literally shake hands with the devil, it only seems absolutely logical that there's another entity, because there is that extreme of evil, there is the other extreme of the purest of good.
For Ramiro, it has been very, very good for him to be able to go back to certain places and to see the people there. I hope that he'll be able to see the reality of what it is now instead of what it was then.
Yeah.
Bonjour. Bonjour.
It is paradise, and that paradise got terribly challenged and nearly destroyed. But it's resilient, and it's the resiliency that we took contact with. One thing's for sure, it'll be a year, maybe two, but certainly a year, that Elizabeth and I will live in Rwanda. That will be the serenity that I long for ultimately. God travels the earth during the day but comes and rests in Rwanda at night. Here, I want to show you where in all this I could find myself. And I could find the solace and be one with my soul, with my heart, with my being.
I used to call him my Canadian hero. I still call him like that. And on you side, he said, don't say that, I'm no hero. She said, I mean, you are.
Stan! Stan!
Oh no, I was very proud of him though. Oh my, yeah. Run! He did the right thing and he's so happy he did. It was hard for all of us, but it wasn't hard when you look at what those people have gone through in Rwanda. We're all here today.
The term hero, to me, doesn't fit. I don't know what term would, but hero doesn't. It doesn't offend, but it makes me terribly at ease because I don't believe it is a deserving qualifier. The mission failed, and there's no doubt about that. And my ultimate failure is having not convinced the international community of what was going on and simply not been able to shame them. And I think that's the responsibility of command I had in the field. And that was my duty.
There's something tremendously ennobling about Romeo Dallaire. There is a core of unwavering principle. He's subject to human frailty, God knows we all are. And he may not have made the right judgment in every single instance in Rwanda, who can tell after the event. But there's something so profoundly good about the man and how strongly he attempted to resist the forces of evil. It's a very memorable moment in human history, Dallaire's conduct in Rwanda. So he shouldn't beat himself up. By God, he was the only reasonable figure in the midst of this chaos of Machiavellian behavior.
Once a suicidal attempt was all based on the fact that I realized that I would never be able to get Rwanda out of my system. That it would always be there, ad vitam aeternam. And it seemed so crushing that I simply couldn't see the future. Now I've come to live with it. I hope my family will be able to read my book one day and they can come to grips with it, but that's not yet. Nelson, comment ça va, mon Nelson? Viens-tu juste d'arriver?
Oui, oui.
Ah, et Sarto?
Ça va bien?
Il manque des cheveux, Christy. Mais comment ça va, toi, mon maudit Bali?
Es-tu beau?
Ça, t'es beau, certain. We are now part of the veterans crew for sure. We've got gray hair and war stories, you know, and our wives and things. And that's true. I think we qualify now. It's been 10 years. I think it's as if it was yesterday. So to you all, good health and many fond memories. Not only the past, but the ones that we'll have into the future. Au plaisir.
All right, everyone look at this camera and smile, please.
So the trip was a very important reference point. You're hoping that, in fact, ultimately, this is part of a positive evolution. But there's this sense, having lived catastrophes like that, that there's always this looming that something is going to appear that's going to cut you right at the knees, and then you're back down to where you were. You're always testing yourself. You're not just living. You're always testing.
Tu cabura bo tua banye. Tu quiri e quirin tira yuko. Tu za hurira yo. Beko! Hazard.